From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Tuesday when Republicans in New York State and across the country celebrated big wins on Election Day. Just hours later, the analyst declared the surprise loser in this year's elections, climate change policy. Republicans took control of the U.S. Senate, and Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma is now in line to be the new chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee. Inhofe is one of the most outspoken critics of climate science, and he wrote a book entitled The Great Hoax: How the Global Warming Conspiracy Threatens Your Future. But the headlines have started to diverge a bit in the past 5 days. Here's Vox, quote, "The biggest loser in this election is the climate." Here's Mother Jones agreeing in their headline, quote, "The climate lost big time in Tuesday's election." On Powerline, conservative writer John Hinderaker celebrated, then looked at the forecast and said, quote, "Coming winter blast is just another stake in the heart of climate change alarmists." But Slate countered today in its typically Slatean contrarian fashion with this headline this morning, quote, "The fact that climate change lost in the election could be a huge win." So what do the election results mean for climate policy? We wanted to talk to advocates for change and for new legislation to find out if the election was as rough for them as the initial headlines suggest. This hour, we welcome Lawrence Torchello, who is an RIT ethics professor. Lawrence, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me,
Evan. We have Abigail McHugh-Griffa, who is with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Abigail, nice to see you.
Thanks so much.
And Susan Spencer's here. She's a solar scientist, the U.S. Ambassador for Solar Aid. Susan, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me on, Evan.
Susan, I'm going to start with you. Tuesday night, Wednesday, as bad as the initial headline suggests for people who advocate for climate change policy in terms of actual legislation, yes or no?
I would say the results were disappointing, primarily because of the low voter turnout that we experienced. But this legislation is not going to die and will indeed have to move forward one way or the other.
When she says this legislation, we're going to be talking about what she means, because there are questions on what policy should be adopted. We're going to get into that. But early reactions. Abigail, Tuesday's election results, your thoughts?
I spent about a day thoroughly depressed and then sort of picked myself back up, you know, time to keep going, fighting the good fight.
Professor?
Unfortunately, these results were predictable, and you could see that the Senate was probably going to be reclaimed by the Republicans. It's unfortunate and sad and frustrating to watch happen.
Here's Slate. In their article, according to exit poll data, global warming is now the most polarizing issue to Republicans, beating even President Obama's signature health care laws. Wow. But they go on to say, but at least it's an issue. This is in sharp contrast to 2012, when the two presidential candidates barely mentioned climate change at all. Even if the 2014 election wasn't primarily about climate, it was one of the social issues that resonated most strongly with voters, according to exit poll data. So Slate is saying, hey, be heartened by the fact that even if it's polarizing, people are thinking about it. They're talking about it. But in another sense, if it's so polarizing, if it becomes a political issue, then do we lose the conversation and it just becomes another hinge point in the culture wars? Professor?
I think that we need to actually build upon, as Slate is suggesting, the fact that this is in people's minds right now. And I think that's the only key to success in actually doing anything meaningful on climate change in a couple of years. And I think we have to couple that topic with related topics like campaign finance reform, which I think goes hand in hand with a concern for the environment, given the current political atmosphere.
Abigail?
Well, you know, I would say that we've already seen a really important shift in the conversation, even among Republicans, from the "it's a hoax" line to now they've shifted a little more to the, well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't comment on that, which, you know, it really is just another way of saying, I really don't want to talk about this issue. But it has become something, you know, I think the numbers show something about in the 70% range of Americans are concerned about this issue. So Republicans are going to have to start coming up with some solutions in order to keep votes. So that's very positive.
And Susan, do you take that? Do you think Slate's bending too far to try to create a positive spin? Or do you at least take heart that this is moving the needle at least.
Well, I think when we zoom out from the specific polarization of the Republican Party, there is some cold, hard reality that is hitting them, and that is the Department of Defense states that climate change is a mission reality, not a political debate. Major investment companies and insurance corporations are now planning their future on the policies that are going to be set by America and the international community over the next couple years. So the ability to believe or not believe, I think, is a luxury that they will soon be losing.
When it comes to the Republican split that has been mentioned here in our panel, here's an example. Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska has said that climate change is not a hoax, that it is real, but she wants to see more domestic energy. Now, she's from Alaska, so she's in favor of more drilling, more energy production. But again, she's saying it's not a hoax. Then you have Senator James Inhofe. What I want to do is I want to play a couple of minutes of what Senator Inhofe has had to say recently about climate change. Again, now that the Republicans have taken the control of the U.S. Senate, Senator Inhofe is in line to be the chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate. His book is called The Great Hoax, How the Global Warming Conspiracy Threatens Your Future. We're not going to spend this hour debating whether climate change is real, but you do have Senator Inhofe taking a lot of power. This is somebody with a lot of power, and I want to listen to the way he describes this issue, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
First of all, this has been an orchestrated event started by the United Nations back in the late 90s. To make people using scare tactics, think that global warming is coming and all kinds of bad things are going to happen to us. So when I became chairman of the Environment Public Works Committee 3.5 years ago, I thought, let me find out if it's going to cost this much money to sign the Kyoto Treaty, as the Horton School of Economics, the Horton Econometric Survey stated. Then let's make sure the science is right, only to find out that almost all science since 1999 has refuted what one man, Michael Mann, said about the hockey stick. Remember the famous hockey stick, where he plotted out the temperatures from about the 3rd century to the 20th century, and then all of a sudden they started getting warmer. What he forgot to do, he neglected to do, intentionally, I think, was put in the medieval warming period, when temperatures were warmer than they are today. That was around 800 to 1200 AD. Then we went into the Little Ice Age. So it came out of that around the turn of the century. Now, if they really believe that there is a relationship between CO2 and climate change, then how can they explain the fact that the largest emission of CO2 in recorded history occurred in the middle and late 40s, and that precipitated a cooling period so severe that the same magazines like Time magazine, who now is trying to scare people into thinking that all the ice is melting and all that, they were writing articles, another ice age is coming, we're all going to die. So the thing has been well orchestrated, and when I became chairman of this committee, I thought, why are politicians so afraid of the environmental extremists? And the answer, I guess, a lot of it is they're the ones who pump the money into the campaigns.
That is Senator James Inhofe. And the panel is slowly exhaling. Susan Spencer, I'm going to start with you because, again, we're not going to spend the hour on this. This program, I as a host, it's my prerogative to trust evidence and scientists, and I do on this issue. And I don't want it to become a political issue. I also don't want to offend people who view it that way, but I trust science. At the same time, this is a senator with a lot of sway and influence now, and he's making some of these claims. So let me start with however you want to respond. He's made a lot of very specific claims. What do you think?
Sure. I think I would touch on two points from what the senator said there. The first, he mentioned the two things that would prevent him from participating are the cost of signing treaties and the agreement of science. So for the first one, it's been calculated and released by the IPCC AR5 report, the International Panel on Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that was released last week, that we would only see a 0.06% impact on global economic growth if we sign the treaty and reduce our emissions and switch to renewables. So the argument about renewables not being cost effective is demonstrably false. Second, he talks about the agreement of science. And again, he is demonstrably wrong in that regard. In terms of Michael Mann's hockey stick graph, there have been at least 14 separate independent reviews of that work that has found it to be scientifically accurate and valid. In terms of the medieval warming that he claims is the reason why that graph is wrong, what he's talking about is that medieval warming existed in certain parts of the globe. But when you look at the entire global temperature, it was cooler than where we are now. So this is a great example of cherry-picking data, which is a very common tactic that is used by people in the denier machine, the people that are really trying to keep us beholden to the fossil fuel industry as long as possible.
He also has said 18 years without real global warming, Susan, and you've heard that. John Hinderaker said the same thing in Powerline. 18 years without any warming disproves that warming is happening.
And again, it comes down to how scientists interpret data. And what scientists do is look at averages over long periods of time.
Yeah.
And we take into account as much as we possibly can all of the variables and factors that are occurring. And what we see, the scientific community agrees that the temperature has been warming for the last 3 decades. And not only that, 13 out of the past 14 years are some of the hottest years on record.
So he's cherry-picking data.
Agreed.
Okay. But this is someone with a lot of sway. And so Professor Torcello from RIT, an ethics professor. I don't know James Inhofe, never met him or interviewed him. Assuming he believes what he's saying there, do you think there should be any kind of... obviously, you disagree with him,
yes.
And science disagree. Scientists yes. disagree with him. But should there be a penalty? Should there be any kind of a sanction for, in your view, what is an incorrect interpretation of important data and policy?
Well, to say the very least, and put this in, and to put this in terms that Republicans favor, if he was in the private sector, he would be fired for being unqualified for the position he holds. Or at the very least, we could say that he's now being promoted to a position where he's completely unqualified. And that's because he fails to keep up with any of the relevant information or research. And I'd like to think that we should expect more from our politicians. And I routinely tell my students when I teach a course in political philosophy that I'm going to hold you to a higher standard that the public holds our elected representatives. And they all get a laugh, but I'm being dead serious. Anything like that in my class would be met with, you know, a heavy rebuttal and a reference to the accurate scientific literature. One thing that jumps out, despite the incredible irresponsibility. First, to answer your question, yes, there should be a penalty. Hopefully, the penalty comes from citizens who wake up to the irresponsibility of somebody who speaks like that in public. Secondly, he refers to environmental money. I'm waiting for my dual checks from big environment and big philosophy now, and they haven't come yet. But it is the case that we could look up how much money he's received from the fossil fuel industry over his years, and it's enormous in there, leading the pack of campaign donations to him and other Republicans. It's always uncomfortable, I think, for any of us to talk about this subject because we want to be fair-minded, and in academia, this is a virtue that I think good academics want to have, is a sense of fairness. And you can't help but sound or feel as if you're somebody who's completely biased towards the Democratic Party when you talk on this subject. But it's just the fact that the entire Republican Party now has adopted this as a platform.
Well, the broader party has in many ways adopted
the mainstream
an opposition to new legislation or new policy related to it, whether they agree with Senator Inhofe or not, because I do think there's disagreement within the Republican Party on what James Inhofe is saying, but there is more unity on, is there an economic way to actually move forward without crippling ourselves?
Right, and there are levels of denialism here. One thing I'll say is that however you feel about this issue, whether you are predisposed to accept the scientific consensus which exists or not, I think it's important that if you're going to be speaking about this topic in public and you disagree, you should at least acknowledge that the scientific community holds this view, that this is a consensus view held by science. Once you do that, you have limited options. You either have to provide evidence as to why the scientific community is incorrect, which is a hard thing to do given the reality of science and the rigors of scientific research. Or the default typically is that there's some sort of hoax going on, which is absurd if you trace out the consequences of what that hoax would actually involve and the cover-up of a global community of researchers that are really motivated to disagree with each other in order to advance science and their professional standing. So in a sense, there's something good about Inhofe, that he kind of implies that there's a scientific consensus when he says there's a hoax. And there's something better about that than pretending that there isn't a scientific consensus, which happens when Republicans say that, hey, I'm no scientist. There's something more disingenuous about that. And so, though I think Inhofe is incredibly irresponsible, the fact that he's going full into the hoax route, which I hope any reasonable person would see, is very problematic. I think he's being, in some sense, honest. I think he believes what he's saying. I think that to his credit. And I don't think I can say that for many other Republican leaders.
Well, that's an interesting distinction, Professor, because you're right in that there is a desire from some people who don't want to see climate legislation, policy, that they're worried about economic impact. They're saying that there is some kind of debate within the scientific community, that it is kind of a split, whereas Inhofe is not. He's saying, no, science says X, Y, Z, but they're all just hoaxing. Yeah. And so that's a very interesting distinction and not a way that I had thought about the issue. So, okay, so let's talk a little about the policy. And before we get to some of your calls, if you want to join the conversation, you can do that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. As we've said, reasonable people can disagree about what the best policy is. What is a viable policy? What is a policy that is good for the economy? What's a policy that could be rough in the short term but better in the long term? These are all reasonable debates to have. A little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about interesting developments with solar and with a solar scientist here. I know Susan's waiting to do that. But when it comes to actual legislation, whether it's cap and trade, carbon tax, the pipeline. What's the name of the pipeline?
Keystone XL.
The Keystone. My goodness. Sorry. Mm-hmm. What a prepared host I am. The Keystone pipeline. And the question of what the president will do now that there's likely going to be something coming to his desk with the Republican houses of Congress. Let's talk about the actual policies. So I'm going to go around the table and let's talk about what stands out to you in terms of actual policy that could be impacted by last week's elections or that you'd like to see go forward. Susan.
Well, I think what I will touch on is international policy that will be impacted by last week elections. So we are leading up to the COP21, the Paris Accords, as they are called. So this is similar to the Kyoto Protocol in the 90s, where we are climate scientists, the UN, every single nation in the world is working towards a binding and enforceable treaty signed by all nations that will set the global emission reduction target and the renewable energy transfer target with the ultimate goal of keeping the maximum global warming temperature to 2 degrees Celsius. So these accords, in order to be ratified here in the United States, require the 60% majority ratification. And when we do not have a viable majority of individuals in Congress that will stand behind this legislation, President Obama will be unable to sign it. And if the United States does not sign this treaty, it could be catastrophic, frankly, for the future of the planet, both economically and environmentally.
If this treaty doesn't get signed, is this the hinge point where for the next 5, 10 years, to a couple decades, where you can either get unity among the global community in terms of trying to reduce emissions, or if we miss this, the chance goes by the boards?
In my professional opinion, yes. The United States has an enormous role and responsibility in signing this treaty and participating in all of the diplomatic negotiations ahead of time. And if we don't do it, there are plenty of countries that are happy to step up and stand in our place. China is the one that comes to mind primarily. They will be the driver of this treaty if we don't step up.
Don't we also hear, Susan, though, that if there's no leadership from the United States on emission reduction, et cetera, it's unlikely that others will follow suit, that others will say, look, the United States is not interested or doesn't believe it to be a priority, and neither do we.
I think that is often the case. The interesting point about China is that they are having to deal with their record levels of emission and pollutions at a very day-to-day existence point. So you can't see out of your window in Beijing. So their president is incredibly focused on this legislation, and in fact is incredibly focused on getting the U.S. to participate, because all countries around the world don't want to be the only one bearing the economic burden of switching over. If everybody steps up, ratifies the treaty, and takes this on board, then this is going to be very economically prosperous for everyone. But if one of the major players does not, then it could be catastrophic.
All right. And what's the timeline for that?
The treaty is going to be signed in Paris in December 2015. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes buildup going on right now for that.
13 months. Abigail McHugh-Griffa, who is with this Rochester group. Do you look at these global issues, or do you look at last Tuesday's elections and say, are there statewide issues that you'd like to see addressed or are concerned about?
You know, I think there are people in town who are working on this at every level, and that's really how these problems need to be addressed. There are local issues, quite a few of them, that we need to deal with right here in Rochester, statewide, national, international. And honestly, I'm in various ways involved with all of those. Right here locally, we do have some very exciting things going on in terms of at least trying to move the conversation forward on these issues, to put pressure on our legislators to do something. Sort of on the immediate horizon, Dr. James Hansen will be in town this coming April. He's pretty much one of the biggest names in climate activism in our country, a former NASA scientist. And he'll be here, and we're organizing a week-long event surrounding that visit. Just try to bring awareness, really, to these issues and help people understand that, yes, we need our politicians to do something, but the chances of our politicians doing something without us demanding that they do something are slim to none. So it's really, you know, the time to just sit and wait for someone else to take care of this, that time has passed.
Okay. And before I get to the phones, if you're on the phones waiting to jump in, we're going to get to you in a moment here. I look at the Manhattan March, which was, is that September? Was that in September? Where you had thousands in the streets of Manhattan.
Hundreds of thousands.
Okay. Thank you, Susan.
Around 400,000.
Around 400,000 in the streets of Manhattan. But here are some of the images that stood out to me. And tell me, Abby, if I'm off base here, when you have what you have in this country right now is, yeah, you've got James Inhofe and some people who say this is not happening. The bigger debate is acknowledging that it's happening, but economically, what can be done? What's feasible? What would hurt us too badly? What's fair and what's not? You know, those kind of questions. And what you have to do if you're going to win a fight, and I'm not choosing sides, I'm looking at you saying if you're in the People's Climate Coalition is going to win, you've got to convince people who disagree with you. I see signs that say fracking is death. And I say, I don't know that that convinces anybody who disagrees, does it?
You know, there's been a lot of research done on the communication of climate science. And no, I think generally speaking, that doomsday ranting and raving is not particularly effective. But there's, you know, the reality piece. I think it's really important to recognize that there has been a deliberate, very, very deliberate and well-funded campaign to shed doubt on climate science. And you know, I mean, we talk about the hoax scenario. It is not a hoax. But a lot of sort of regular everyday folks believe that because those messages are strong in our society. So, you know, it was interesting with the People's Climate March. Having been there, it was a very powerful event, all sorts of diverse groups coming together around this issue. But you know what? The mainstream media barely covered it. not one of the, what are they called, network news.
Big networks, yeah.
Yep, their Sunday morning news programs. This march was literally going on live out front of their studios. Not a single one covered it. And you got to question why that is. You know, it's, you got to question why.
Do you have an answer, Professor?
Well,
I see you smiling.
Well, I just wanted to chime in. You know, I've noticed yesterday, that the, I believe the only news show that was actually talking about the election in terms of climate was on Fox. Everyone else is really interested in the horse race, but they really are on a mission to make sure that they hit the talking points that undermine the science. And it's working. It's working very well. And this disinformation campaign is working so effectively that people, and in fact, because so many Republicans at the political level are buying into denialism in the House of Representatives, I think the mainstream media has become shy about talking about it because it feels as if they're picking too much on Republicans. In the same way that I feel awkward talking about it because I feel like I appear to be a radical liberal just because the facts are that one party has adopted denialism as a major part of their political efforts.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, again, on this broadcast, we try to be as fair and even-handed as we can, but I'm not averse to saying that I trust science and that I'm always open to changing my mind. I'm always open to new evidence. I try to avoid confirmation bias, and that's one thing I bet your professor could give us an hour on.
Yeah, we all should. And, you know, science does too, and that's the wonderful thing about it because it's a rigorous, organized effort to avoid confirmation bias as opposed to pseudoscience, which is cherry-picking and going out to confirm what you believe ahead of time. And that's one of the things we see between those who are actual scientists, like Susan here, and those like Christopher Monckton or some of the other well-known deniers making themselves very loudly heard on the internet.
All right, let me start to get to a few calls. This is Nelson in Rochester. Go ahead, Nelson.
I'm listening very carefully to you, and I'm looking at the same time at five books that are sitting here, from Lester Brown to Englander to Cousteau to, and then finally, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. When we made the atomic bomb and saved the world from somebody else having the atomic bomb, Russia or Germany, we finally ended up arguing, the scientists did, when they were working 80 hours a week, do we want the fat boy or do we want the thin man? They couldn't make up their minds. Watch the TV series, The Manhattan. They finally made up their minds the right way, and we got the bomb first. Now, that may have saved something, aside from 1 million or 2 million American soldiers, but the fact is, you're doing nothing now when you and the media debate whether or not we've given enough fair time to the idiots who want to protect oil. We began in Iraq with evidence that they wanted to protect oil. We began with their attacks on EPA. Fracking, whether it's good or bad, the fact is we don't have EPA in fracking. That's because of protecting oil. Make your enemies clear, make your friends clearer, and you're keeping your enemies close to you, but talk about your friends. Either we do this, particularly if we're not the leader, because can you see China leading the move to prevent global warming, or Russia?
Or India?
That's what you're doing. Because it is, no one's expecting to become the leader of the world to protect global warming, and that's what you're talking about. That's it.
Well,
I'll take off my mask.
Nelson, first of all, thank you. And I'm playing Jim Inhofe's comments because he is in a position of power and prominence now, and what we wanted to do was frame this discussion in the context of the election, which makes it more difficult now to enact certain policies. And this show doesn't take a position on certain individual pieces of legislation. We're looking at the wider view that says the landscape is more difficult for that now. And Jim Inhofe's of the world are part of the reason why. But I also take the point that if we spend too much time on Jim Inhofe, we may lose sight of the ball, I guess, a little, Susan.
Well, I think, thank you for your call, Nelson. I think that he's accurate in his statement that it is really important to call out the reasons why we are even having this discussion right now. And the reason is the fossil fuel industry. And the fossil fuel industry's campaign donations, as Professor Torricello pointed out earlier, leave a very stark trail of money to party members who have participated in very aggressive acts of denialism, like Senator Inhofe. So the fossil fuel industry does not want to change. It does not want to go to renewable energy. It does not want to have that happen. And the reason is money. And they will, at all costs, do what it takes to protect their investments and their what they perceive as their future economic security.
Yeah, and Nelson, that's partially why we're having this discussion now, because this landscape has shifted in a week now. This is Peter in Rochester, is the chair of the local chapter of the Sierra Club, and he's on the line with us now. How are you, Peter?
Well, I would be better, I think, if I could be more hopeful. But I wanted to make a comment about reflecting the ideas around policy change and how there are things that, yes, they might cause a little pain in a sense, but it would be barely noticeable in the sense of just last week there was an article in the paper about the low gas prices and the fact that Rochester's are higher than others, even though they had dropped quite a bit. And an example of a policy change that would cause a little bit of pain but would generate the funds we need to start making the transition to better mass transportation and more efficient use of energy would be to have a policy tax that would generate a tax on top of the gasoline price to keep it at about the same level, which people were already accustomed to, and then all of the surplus funds, yes, there would be some bookkeeping, that would be used to generate to help support a high-speed rail and better bus transportation in cities and things like that. And perhaps the same thing could be done with vehicles. When you look at the papers and you look at what's selling and what's selling well and you look at all the SUVs and their poor fuel efficiency, why isn't there a tax on that? So there are things that could be done like that that, yes, would cause a little bit of pain, but it would generate the funds we need to prepare for the future.
Peter, let me jump in and ask you a question based on your comment on the gas tax, for example. I really hope I'm not misquoting Kent Gardner, who is an economist for the Center for Governmental Research here in Rochester. But my recollection is Kent and I had a discussion, and he said this is one of those places where if you want to move public action and public behavior, a tax can do that effectively. And again, this is what Kent's saying. Number one, a gas tax, raising the gas tax, will almost certainly cut down on consumption of fossil fuels, which is sort of desirable in many people's eyes, and it will raise money for government to enact sort of alternatives. Exactly what you're describing. The difference is, I think Kent would say this, and again, Kent, if I've misquoted you, I will correct it immediately tomorrow morning or tomorrow on this program. But the difference is there is very little appetite for a gas tax. It is almost political death right now, isn't it, Peter?
I would agree. And so this is part of the thing that I believe is critical that I think it takes something in our society to be really thinking about the consequences of all the things that are being projected that are going to happen due to climate change and think about our children and grandchildren, because many of us will probably be dead or dying at the time when some of these disaster effects are occurring. But we have the opportunity now to do those things to prepare for the future so that the children don't have to suffer the consequences.
All right.
And I think that's probably the only way to really appeal to people, to get them to take action.
Peter, thanks for the call. It's nice to hear from you. And when it comes to the question of a gas tax, right now we've got people celebrating that gas is back down below $3. And the last thing that's probably politically viable is saying, let's get it back to $4 in the form of a tax. But again, Peter's saying we have to appeal to people on future generations. Professor?
Thanks for your call, Peter. And I'm very sympathetic to that view. And I think that you're right. And I think part of the problem, why we don't have an appetite for that sort of sacrifice, is because we don't have a realistic view of what's really at stake here. And Abigail mentioned earlier the science of science communication. And we have to be very careful not to be too negative. But I think it's useful for us to have a sobering dose of reality in terms of the sort of environmental disasters that are on the way if we proceed business as usual. And to connect this back a little bit with Nelson's previous call, where he was talking about World War II era policies, one of the things that was remarkable about that era is the amount of sacrifice that people were willing to make for the war effort. They were willing to ration. They were willing to have victory gardens. They were willing to do all sorts of things that, if we were to adopt a similar attitude now, would go a long way into getting us on the right track with climate change. And the sort of sacrifice involved in attacks and rationing. And, you know, victory gardens, we need victory forests. That's the sort of thing that we should be looking at doing. And I think yeah, it's time that the public begins to realize we have to sacrifice and step up to the ethical challenge that's in front of us. And perhaps take some pride in our ability to do that once we do.
Abigail?
You know, Peter, I really appreciate your call, especially, you know, you sort of redirected us back to this policy question. I think the assumption that this is about sacrifice, maybe we will drive less, but maybe we'll have the alternative of taking public transportation. I don't know that the sacrifice angle, certainly I don't think it's going to sway public opinion too well, but I think that a well-implemented policy could make this actually, it could fuel our economy, could bring us together as communities. You know, one policy proposal I'm particularly interested in is this idea of a carbon fee and dividend plan, which would essentially place a tax on carbon emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions, and then that revenue would be redistributed back to American households. So rather than it growing the size of government, it would be given back to the people to, you know, use how they saw fit. This has a number of advantages, one of which is simply that it encourages people to cut back on their own emissions, not because they're making a moral choice, which, yes, that does appeal to some people. I'm all for let's make the right choice. But there are a lot of people that's not going to get them on board. They need the option that it's going to be good for their personal self-interest, for their pocketbook. And there are policy proposals out there that do exactly that. So I think if we can focus on, you know, a well-implemented piece of legislation, we can solve the problems and not need necessarily to make it about sacrifice.
But realistically right now, based on last Tuesday, that kind of legislation doesn't have much of a chance in the next couple of years, does it?
Oh, no, I would disagree. You know, Republicans certainly are interested in a market-based solution. And there are definitely ways to do this where we put a tax on it and then sort of let it play out in the market. So it's not about more regulation. You know, the Republicans have expressed a lot of discontent with Obama's executive order for the EPA, the new EPA rules. That's the kind of thing that, you know, I mean, Obama hasn't had much of a choice, actually. That's sort of the only route he's been allowed. But were we able to do this in a way that was, you know, market-based, and it is possible. I mean, actually, I think there are a lot of perhaps closed-door discussions that are going on, even that, you know, the Republicans haven't been able to speak out about this because it was political suicide. But at least at this point, they've got 2 years of job security, and there actually is real opportunity to move this conversation forward.
Susan, brief response there as well.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that has been said so far. In terms of, again, economic impact, I just want to put some facts out there that the economic impact of not doing anything is so much higher than action. The IPCC report puts out that if we delay significant emission cuts to 2030, we're going to increase the cost of reducing carbon dioxide by almost 50%. That is an enormous number because we're talking about billions and billions of dollars. What is required is, at a global level, investment into low carbon electricity and energy efficiency. And for us to do that, the calculations from the IPCC report is that our global annual economic growth rates of 1.3 to 3% would only go down by 0.06% for this renewable energy transfer. So there's the environmental impact, and there's also the economic impact. And I think speaking to the economic impact is really important because it is not as damaging to the economy as it is often made out to be. It's actually very good for the economy.
Well, and I think if you don't win that argument, especially with the climate, with the Republican success last week, this kind of legislation doesn't have a future in the short term.
Go ahead. Chime in really quickly. I'm not that optimistic about this happening domestically for the reasons that you're citing. I'm not optimistic that this would have happened if what happened last week didn't happen politically. I don't think that we were going to be signing anything anyway. I think that other countries understand the climate in the United States right now, the political climate, and know that they're going to have to move on without us in some sense and hope that a politically binding agreement, which is what Obama is working on now, could somehow work out for us. But because of what Susan just referenced and the cost effectiveness of setting this now, this is why I actually have some optimism internationally, because I think that they're not suffering from the sort of denialist problem that we're in the grips of. And they're going to move on and do what's in their own best interests in a much more rational way than we seem capable of right now.
I'm way late for a break. Here's what we're going to do. Every phone line is filled. So the first thing the host has to do is figure out what we can't do. And I don't even think we can have a detailed discussion on solar. We're going to have another hour for this.
Sure thing.
And Susan Spencer, I'm sure as a solar scientist, you know other people who are involved with installation, all kinds of other things. There is a very interesting article in Mother Jones called Here Comes the Sun, America's Solar Boom in Charts. And when it comes to policy, will solar be more part of the conversation? We'll set aside a separate hour for that very soon, because
excellent.
I think this is a big part of it, don't you?
I agree, yes.
Okay, so let's take a break. If you're on the phone, we're going to try to get to as many calls as we can in the last 12 minutes of the program. Be ready when we come back next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, Mark Assini joins us in studio the first hour. He's still counting the votes and hoping that he will come out ahead of Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. But either way, Mr. Assini says it was a big night for him on election night. How did he nearly pull the surprise? What was the strategy? Then we talk about 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall with someone who was right there. That's Tuesday on Connections.
In Iraq, ISIS paints itself as powerful and pious, but comedy programs there turn that image on its head.
What anti-ISIS parodies do is they move the image from the domain of the heroic. So you have the caliph on a pedestal, you pull him down and make him look ridiculous, make him look grotesque.
That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 o'clock on your public radio station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our topic this hour, the elections last week. What's the impact on climate policy legislation going forward, particularly for those who've been advocating for some rather significant changes or new ideas? Did last week sort of put a damper on that? And what happens in the next 2 years, 5 years, and going forward? We're talking to Lawrence Torcello, an RIT ethics professor. Susan Spencer is a solar scientist and the U.S. Ambassador for Solar Aid. Abigail McHugh Griffa is with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. And Susan, we wanted to talk more about solar this hour. We just don't have time to really get into the depth I want, so we'll set it aside for a different day. But a short answer, when it comes to scalable technology, when we talk about moving on eventually from fossil fuels, whenever it happened, you need something that is scalable. Solar shows more signs now of becoming scalable than a lot of people had expected.
Solar is ready to go. It is coming down in cost, improving dramatically in quality, and it can be implemented at a individual as well as grid level.
Is there legislation and policy that is designed to make this more viable, and should there be?
There should be, and there is some. The great thing about solar is it is becoming so cost effective that the ability to implement it can even outstrip the need for legislation.
All right, let's get to the phones and let's try to be very fast moving as best we can because they're filled up. Joyce in Penfield. Go ahead, Joyce.
Yes, thanks. Great program. Regarding media not covering the climate change march, in our very own area, there has been a really immense outpouring around the issue of the Seneca Lake the potential destruction and desecration of the lake and the water because of the Crestwood Midstream's LPG storage and compressor construction site. They have a plan to store massive quantities of highly explosive LPG in old, unstable salt caverns that are under the lake. It's a huge, grave threat to the region. 300 people turned out a week before last to protest it, and then on October 29th, a part of an ongoing group was there and blocked entrance, and 10 people were arrested. This is, and in case there's any question about whether this is going to be serious, the company itself filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They had to include what the risks might be. And they, in that document, they have said their business, quote, involves many hazards and risks, some of which may be not fully covered by insurance. Vessel ruptures, corrosion, explosions, leaks, migrations or losses of natural gas, collapse of storage caverns, environmental pollution, etc. So they have even said that, and yet they actually got the go-ahead from the federal government for one piece of this, and the LPG storage as well as methane are the questions. So what they want to do is industrialize that gorgeous area, the wineries, every one of the counties, except for every one of the towns, except for the host town, has opposed it. Yet they're going ahead. And did you see it in the newspaper?
I did, Joyce. And only because I'm going to run out of time, I want to get to other calls. I got to let you go. But let me just say, I know Abigail McHugh Griff has been big on this. This is one of those local issues we've talked about. We need to set aside more time because it's somewhat unfair, again, to try to get this in a minute and a half. But I know that's one that's on your radar, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is just one of a number of local issues, including we've got the Bakken oil trains going through our area. Very scary thing. They have this tendency to blow up. Also fracking, of course, and the risks of fracking. So, yes, I agree. We need to set aside a separate hour for discussion.
We'll talk LPG because, again, I don't want to reduce that discussion. And I understand Joy's concern as well. But, Joyce, I promise you, we will set aside a separate hour. We'll talk to the company as best we can, and we'll give them an opportunity to come on the program as well. This is Frank in Rochester. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, I wonder if your guest can help clear up the climate change debate by talking about the difference between mitigation and adaptation.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Frank. Go ahead, guys.
Okay, so we could either stop this problem now or at least do our very best to slow global warming, or we could deal with its consequences later. Personally, I'm for the let's do something about it now. For one thing, it would be less expensive. And, you know, It's scary to think about what global warming could mean for our future. Things like food and water shortages, of course, that sort of thing tends to lead to war. Our area, there's the sort of low-scale adaptation of we need to update our infrastructure to deal with increased extreme weather events. You know, our sewer systems just can't handle it. But then there's also the sort of larger issue of what do we do when climate refugees start coming to our area? So again, let's set apart a whole nother area to talk about that. Another hour.
But again, I think what she's saying is mitigation versus adaptation means you'd rather not pay Tuesday for a hamburger today. That we might as well start to, and we say paying now, but Susan and Abigail have been consistently saying that's also the wrong way to frame the argument. That sacrifice, as we've said, is an important concept morally, but it's more than just you have to pay a lot now.
I think it is critical, though, that I state clearly that climate scientists believe that both mitigation and adaptation are going to be required.
Yeah.
We are past the point where we can just mitigate. We are also going to have to adapt to the global warming that we have already caused and will not be able to stop. An example of this is the loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So we can mitigate the rate at which we lose the ice sheet into the sea, but we're going to lose it. It's going to be gone, and we're going to have to adapt to the resulting sea level rise.
Whether it's in decades or centuries.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I just add to that those who have to do the most adaptation are those who aren't as very responsible for the problem so far. Those are the people in the developing world. And one of the things that I think is a real ethical obligation of the United States is to offer aid to the developing world in adapting to the climate change.
That's problem. What Abbey means when she says climate refugee. That's the term you use, right?
Well, those are people who will literally be coming to our area, yes, when their home goes underwater.
The bigger picture for what Professor Torricello is talking about is climate justice.
Yes.
That the first world countries who have created the problem must shoulder the burden of actually fixing it and helping developing countries increase their renewable energy economy so that they don't have to rely on fossil fuels and deal with the immediate drastic effects of climate change, such as rising sea levels, droughts, and flooding.
Okay, so for anybody who had comments that we couldn't get through or callers, this is just one of those stacked hours, and you can see there's offshoot questions, whether it's LPG at Seneca Lake or whether it's climate refugees and certainly solar energy and the viability of solar. We will be hitting those very soon on future programs and trying to get all sides of this. But what I wanted to do this hour is bring some of the folks in who are stakeholders who've said we need these kind of policy changes, and now the concern is that last week might make that more difficult. So let me just ask real briefly. I've got about 90 seconds. One thing, if there's one policy, legislation, or governmental action that you want to see in relation to climate change, Susan, is it Paris 2015 for you?
It is Paris 2015. It's the most important thing that our generation can accomplish.
And the 20-second description of what that is for those who missed it.
The Paris Accords are the binding, enforceable international treaty that will reduce our carbon emissions globally, help us transfer to renewable energies, and keep our warming temperature to 2 degrees Celsius or less.
Abigail, one thing.
We need to put a price on carbon. My preferred way of doing that would be a carbon fee and dividend plan, also known as a revenue neutral carbon tax. More some other day.
Okay, there you go. And Professor?
Well, I agree with them both, but I think that a key to showing good faith in the upcoming Paris meeting is going to be not approving the Keystone XL.
The pipeline.
Yes.
But again, that now looks like it's got much more momentum, doesn't it?
It's on Obama's shoulders now, yeah.
And if he has the political mandate to veto, he will veto.
He hasn't indicated.
No.
I mean, it's not clear yet, is it?
No, I think that we can give him that political mandate.
It's very worrisome. And let me just throw one more thing out there quickly.
Yeah, 20 seconds, go.
More shows like this. I think the biggest key to building a real will to act on climate is more real information out in the media. We should really be giving this a serious attention that deserves. So thank you for the show.
Well, thank you, Professor. And also, I echo the professor's point that he made a couple times this hour wholeheartedly, which is that it is too bad that this has become politically polarized. We don't have to agree on the policy or every exact action, and there will be disagreement. But at the same time, this program trusts science, and that shouldn't be politically polarized. So there we are. Thanks for the time, Susan Spencer, Abigail McHugh-Griffa, Professor Lawrence Torricello. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And see you all soon. And for our listeners, sorry we couldn't get to all of you, but thanks for the wonderful participation. Have a great Monday.